We are on source, or rather sheet 14, in our ongoing series on the development of Torah Musinai. And we are now this week going to talk about bad machlokas. We talked last week and the week before about good machlokas, the idea of intrinsic machlokas. We're now going to look at the machlokas that crept into the system that required a system reboot after the destruction of the Second Temple, which we now call the Talmud. And the Talmud came about, the Mishnah and the Talmud came about as a result of certain realities that set into the system, which were b'di'evad, which we didn't want, as opposed to what we discussed last week was l'chatchila, ideal concepts. And we're going to talk about how that happened this week. What is the origin of machlokas? Have a look, please, on source number one. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos talks about the Shalshelet HaMasorah, the chain of Masorah going down through from Moshe Rabbeinu. And I'm going to focus here on the Second Temple bit. It says, Moshe Kibbul Torah Misinai, U'Masra LeYoshua, V'Yoshua LeZikein Zikeinu, Nevi'im Nevi'im, Masra LeAnshei Knesset HaGedolah. The Nevi'im handed it over to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who lived at the beginning of the Second Temple. We had a couple of sheets on the transition from Nevuah to Chochmah. If you can't remember what we said, it's sheet 8 and sheet 9, and you can download them from the web, and you can listen to them again. Okay? Once we're in the Second Temple period, Nevuah has come to an end. The Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the end of Nevuah, they were the last Nevi'im, Chagai, Malachi, Zechariah. Okay? And they handed it on to a number of different people. So let's carry on. The end of the first line. Shimon HaTzadik, Haya Mishyari Knesset HaGedolah. He was the last of the Knesset HaGedolah. The Knesset HaGedolah was like a super Sanhedrin. It was, instead of being 71, it was a Sanhedrin of 120. The modern day Knesset was designed to copy the idea of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah of 120. That's why it's that number. This was like an emergency Sanhedrin in place for a period of however long it was, 50, 100 years. We're getting into that now. The exact historicity of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah is an interesting debate with the academics. Whether, you know, who these people were and where, but that's not for now. But Shimon HaTzadik, who lived at the time of Alexander the Great, was the last, one of the last people from the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And he says, like, then he goes like this, Antigonus ish Soichoi, kibel mishimon HaTzadik. Antigonus from Socho, okay, received the tradition. He was the most, if you like, in charge of the chain after Shimon HaTzadik. Obviously, he wasn't the only person learning Torah. He was given responsibility, if you like, for the transmission of this Masorah. And then, two individuals who we're going to meet again in a few minutes, Yosi ben Yoezer ish Tzereda, but Yosi ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim, kiblu mehem. They received from the last door, from Antigonus ish Socho. There is actually an interesting Nekudah. It says kiblu mehem, not kiblu mimeno. It sounds like there may be people in this chain which are not recorded. Rav Dovid Tzvi Hoffman talks about that, but that's not for now. That's already more academic point, which is a separate issue. But we are there holding with these two Yosis, okay, around the beginning of the 3rd century BCE. And then Yeshua ben Parachia and Nitai Arbeli kiblu mehem. Yeshua ben Parachia and Nitai Arbeli were the next pair. These were what we call the zugos, the pairs, which were responsible for this transmission of Masorah. And then Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach kiblu mehem. By the way, the Hanukkah story happens around Yosef ben Yoezer ish Tzereda and Yosef ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim. Maybe a little bit after, maybe Yeshua ben Parachia, around about then. Already Shimon ben Shetach is after the Hanukkah story in the time of Alexander Yanai, who was his brother-in-law, who was one of the Hashmonaim afterwards. Then Shammai ba'Avtalion in the 6th generation, Kiblu Mehem. And finally Hillel the Shammai, who you've heard of lots, Kiblu Mehem. And therefore, you have here 7 stages in the Second Temple period. Again, exactly how long the Second Temple period was is an interesting question. I just want to alert you now to something which you may or may not be aware of, which is that there is a missing 163 or 4 years, which I have a whole shiur on, which is not for now. It's an interesting question. Maybe we'll do it as a one-off at some stage when we need a one-off shiur, because the dating system, according to Chazal, is 160 something years shorter in the Second Temple period than the dating system according to the secular authorities. And the secular authorities are not just making it up. They're basing it on records of the Persian kings, of which we have in our records three or four, and there are actually a great deal more than that according to the secular records. And they also base it off eclipses and lunar eclipses and solar eclipses. In other words, you can't just write it off and say, oh, they're all wrong. What exactly happened to these 164 years, why we missed them out, is an interesting question. And there's a lot to be said about that. Rav Shimon Schwab, around 40, 50 years ago, wrote a very detailed analysis of this, which got him into some hot water. Not for now, but for another time maybe. I'm just alerting you to the fact that this issue exists and has been commented on extensively by the Meforshim, and is not something that was discovered by some biblical critics in the last few years. Yes?
Does that mean that we may potentially be 150 years closer?
According to Rav Shimon Schwab, one of the implications of that is it may not be the year 5773, it may be 593 or 42 or something like that, which of course is very exciting if we're all fixated on the year 6000, but that brings in a whole other debate, which is whether the year 6000 really is relevant to Mashiach or not. We all, if you like, accept as Torah Sinai these days that the year 6000 is the, you know, make or break date. It's not straightforward that that's the case. There is one opinion in the Gemara that says that the world, the history is divided into three lots of 2,000 years, but it's not clear whether we follow that opinion. Rabbi Akiva seems, at least at first line, not to follow that opinion when he thinks the Bar Kokhba is the Mashiach, but maybe taking into account the 160 years, it is that opinion. It's more complicated than that. And therefore, I know everyone thinks the Mashiach is coming before the year 6,000, hopefully it's coming this evening, never mind the year 6,000, but don't bank on it. As one of the leaders of the Jewish community said, you should hope for Mashiach this afternoon and plan that he's not coming for another 300 years. In other words, you have to plan. Okay. Now, yes, Rivka.
It says that one of the things that saved us in Egypt was that we kept our name. And why did we start off in...
Right, this is another whole topic which I think a lot is made of, this idea of having a Jewish name. I get your question exactly. In other words, people have stressed an awful lot the importance of having a Jewish name, to the extent that they talk about in Egypt, that they retain their names, although the exact Mishnah, the Midrash there, needs to be looked at more carefully to see what the exact wording of it is. I'm not getting into that now. It's clear, in any event, throughout Jewish history, that there were periods where the leaders of the Jewish people did not have Jewish names. Or rather, the non-Jewish names became Jewish names. Antigonus is not a classic Jewish biblical name. It's clearly a Greek name. Okay, there's no question about it. This was not just some Hellenistic person. This was the head of the Sanhedrin. We find in the Middle Ages that many of the leaders of the community in Sfarad were called Donash and Labrat and Saruk and Maimon and all these things, which are Arabic names. And we find in the Gemara Aramaic names, Hunna and Popper and Zvid and Zera, people like that. So in other words, nobody seems to be bothered, they're not all called Chaim Moshe and Zershalem Zalman, etc., etc. Now what exactly that means, I'm not getting into the implications hashkafically, but there seem to be people, I myself get into this debate quite a lot. It's very interesting in England when I say that my Hebrew name is Avram. And people call me Avram, and I like the name Avram very much. It's a very special name. I'm named after my grandfather, Olam Shalom, who, of course, I never met. But my English name is Anthony, and people call me Anthony as well. And in England, it's absolutely standard. There's lots of rabbis called Anthony. One of the Haredi rabbis of one of the main Haredi schools called Anthony. Anthony's a very Jewish name. In America, people can't quite get their head around it, because Anthony's an Italian name. And they don't, religious people are not called Anthony. And they feel, I sense even a little bit of discomfort. When they advertise my shirim and I'm speaking, they sometimes won't write my name on the thing. They write Rabbi A. Manning. Okay. I don't know why they bother. Just call me Avram. I'm quite happy with Avram. It's not a point of principle for me. But it's quite clear that my own rabbi in London goes to Alan. It's not considered to be something which is a problem. But anyway, yes. I know Jews called Christine. Although I don't think that was because they were purposely called Christine. I think they realized that Christine was named after you-know-who. Fine. Weiter. So they are the seven generations, if you like, of the Shalshalith, Hamasori in the Second Temple period. And I just want to draw your attention to some important things. In number two, we see Shebetchila kishenishdachacha Torah. Torah was forgotten, quotes and quotes. And this word shichacha is an important word. It doesn't just mean forgotten that no one knew what it was. It means a change of paradigm, exactly how we see through the sources how that works. I'm not going to get into now, but there was a major change of paradigm at the time of Ezra, Mi Yisrael, Allah Ezra Mibavel V'Yosta. Ezra came and re-established the Torah, which is very interesting because Ezra made some fundamental changes at the beginning of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah to Torah in terms of Aramaic, in terms of the scripts that we use from Hebrew script to Aramaic scripts which we use today. That's another whole story. There are two big stories to be told about this period, two big shirim to be given. One is on the 164 years and one is on the change of the Hebrew script from the Paleo-Canaanite script to the Aramaic script that we have today. They're both really interesting topics. Which tend to get a little bit ignored because people get a bit nervous about them. But please God, we'll have a chance to have a shirim on them at some stage. So Ezra was fundamental, but with Ezra came some interesting changes. Have a look at number three. The two Yoseis, Yosef ben Yoezer Ishreda and Yosef ben Yochanan Yerushalayim, around the time of Hanukkah. Says like this in number three. The Gemara in Temura says as follows. Nan Hasan. Mishemeis Yosef ben Yoezer Ishreda, Yosef ben Yochanan Yerushalayim. Once these two Yosefs have died, Baklu ha eshkolos ish shehakolboy. The eshkolos, eshkol is a word, an acronym, not an acronym. What's the word? There's a word for a word which is a number of words put together. I'm sorry, what? No. That's when all the letters are all mixed up. Anyway, it's made from ish shehakol. Okay, ish eshkol, ish shehakolbo. A man in which everything is in him. They finished. At that stage, some kind of quality of individual ceased to be at this point in the Jewish history. We'll see a bit more about what that means. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Kol Eshkolos She'amdu Lahem LiYisrael MiYemos Moshe. All of the Eshkolos, all of these people with, you know, all rounders, everything in them, who came from the time of Moshe until Ad Shemeit Yosef Ben Yoezer, the Hayul Lamdim Torah K'Moshe Rabbeinu. They used to learn Torah like Moshe Rabbeinu. Mikan va'elich, but from this point onwards, loy hayo lamdin Torah k'Moshe Rabbeinu. They no longer learn Torah like Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara is alluding to, or saying explicitly, some kind of paradigm shift in the way Torah began to be learned at the death of these two Yoses. What is this issue? Why? What happened? What does it mean that the Eshkolot cease to be? So I brought you another Gemara and a Rashi, which I think throws some light on this. The Gemara at the end of Sota says, "Mishimeis Yosef ben Yoezer Ishred of Yosef ben Yehuda Yerushalayim Batlo Eshkolos." The same idea from that we saw in the Gemara in 3, when these two Yoses died, the Eshkolos all died out. My Eshkolos is the Gemara. What does Eshkolos mean? Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Ish Shehakol Bo, a person in whom everything is included. And if you go over the page to Rashi, you'll see Shehakolbo, Rashi says, Torah, the Amita, these people have real Torah, meaning, the Ein Doifi, the Shichacha, Umachloikas. They manage to avoid Doifi. Doifi means duplicitousness, or duplicity, I should say. Like Doifi, Dibarnu Doifi, when we do vidui, we say we've spoken one thing in our mind, one thing in our heart. We've not been honest. The shichacha and forgetfulness and some kind of breakdown. Umachloikas and machloikas. In other words, after this point in Jewish history, Rashi is explaining there was a yuridus hadoros. There was a decline in the generations that these things slipped into the system. Doifi, which is on some kind of corruption. Shichacha, which is some kind of forgetfulness, and machlokas, which is debate and dispute. And this is clearly negative. This is not positive. This is a decline. And this is linked very clearly with the Gemara number 6, which talks about what Rashi calls the first ever machlokas in the Jewish people, in Halacha. Do you have to see what this means? Have a look at number 6. Yosef ben Yoezer Oimer Shaloi Lismo. Yosef ben Yoezer says not to do smicha. Now, we know who Yosef ben Yoezer is, one of our two Yoses. What is this smicha business? So this is not talking about making rabbis. This is talking about when Yontef, when you have to do smicha on a korban on Yontef, in the Beis HaMikdash, because the Beis HaMikdash was alive and kicking at this time. So you have to put your hands on the head of the korban in order to do smicha before you bring the korban. That was one of the halachas of korban, is smicha. The problem is, on Yom Tov, the animal is muksa. Now on Shabbos, you didn't bring personal offerings, so it was less of an issue. But on Yom Tov, you could. And therefore, the shaila was, are you allowed to use the animal in the way that would be awesome ishum muksa, because of muksa? And this was a machloikas that wouldn't go away. This is the first machloikas that wouldn't go away. So Yosef ben Yehuda said, no, don't do smicha. Leave it out on Yom Tov. Yosef ben Yochanan, who was his partner, Amar, he said, Lisman, you should do smicha. Yoshua ben Parachia, who was in the next generation, who, by the way, the Gemara says in the bit that was censored, was the rabbi of Jesus, and has a whole discussion about how their relationship played out and how Jesus ended up going off the death. Now you'll notice this is a couple of hundred years before the Christian accounts of when Jesus was. That's another whole discussion as to how to sort of place the historical Jesus in the context of the Second Temple period. That's another discussion. Yeshua ben Parachia Omer Shaloi Lismoich, not to do smicha, Nifai Arbeli Omer Lismoich. So again, the two of them disagreed. Yehuda ben Tawai Omer Shaloi Lismoich, Yehuda ben Tawai says don't do it, Shimon ben Shetach says do it. Shammai Omer Shammai says Lismoich, do it. Avtalion Omer Shaloi Lismoich, not to do it. Hillel Umenachem Loi Nechleku. Hillel and Menachem, who were the original pair when Hillel was in, didn't disagree. Yotza Menachem, Menachem left. Interesting question, where did he go? This is a very interesting, fascinating subject. What happened to Menachem? He left and nobody kind of asks why. That's another debate. Lots of teasers in this class, I'm sorry, of things that we're going to talk about one day. Menachem was Hillel's counterpart before Shammai came in. There was Hillel and Menachem. We think of Hillel and Shammai. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Originally the dynamic duo were Hillel and Menachem. Menachem Yotza. Seems he left, not necessarily under good circumstances, but we'll see another time. And then in came Shammai, one second. Nichna Shammai, Shammai came in. And then Shammai Omer Shelo Lismoch, Shammai said, don't do smicha, Hillel Omer Lismoch. In other words, they couldn't resolve it, and Rashi says, V'zohi machlokes Rishayna Shehaita B'chachma Yisrael. This was the first ever machlokes that the Jewish rabbis ever had. Which is an unbelievable statement, because there was machlokes, was there never machlokes before then? The Torah was given 1,000 years before this. Are you telling me there was no machlokes? The whole Tanakh is full of machlokes. The Gemara records machlokes between David and Melech and Shaul and Melech and Achitophel and Doeg and all of these. Why was this the first machlokes? You had a question, Colleen?
Yeah, like, how is this just coming up now? Like,
oh, that's another good question. Why is there a debate about this kind of thing when they've been doing this? Well, you could argue that the halacha of muksa was a new-ish halacha. The halachas of muksa came in as a rabbinic halacha at the Second Temple period, and you could argue that maybe this came in as the beginning of the whole thing. They couldn't work out what to do. But you could argue it other ways. There are some times when for example, where Hillel himself appears on the stage. There's a very fascinating account in the Gemara in Sochim, where Hillel makes his debut with the Jewish people from Babel. Hillel is the one basically after Ezra, in terms of Ezra came like 300 or 400 years before Hillel and redid the whole Torah in some ways. Hillel then came and also made a massive impact like that from Babel. What happened? Hillel came to Yerushalayim when Erev Pesach fell on Shabbos. And there was a big hullabaloo. What should the people do about carrying their knives to shech the Korban Pesach? You can shech the Korban Pesach, that we know you can do, okay? The question is, what about other things on Shabbos that you involve carrying, which are not directly related to the Shechita, and then everyone all of a sudden is like in a big quandary. What should we do? We don't know what to do. We don't know what to do. And this question comes up on that Gemara as well. What do you mean you don't know what to do? How many times has Erev Pesach fallen on Shabbos since the Beis HaMikdash was built? Scores, if not hundreds of times. Okay, all of a sudden, no one knows what to do. It seems it's not that they don't know what to do; it's that they don't know what the source is in the psukim for what to do, which is a different thing. Because at this particular time in history, there were a number of paradigm shifts happening, and one of them is the need to find a textual source in order to learn out the halachas, which I'm not going to get into so much now. But that's also something that's going on. It's part of the shift from the Sora, from prophecy, from tradition to analysis that we talked about with Chochmah. So even if they knew what to do, they couldn't prove it, if you like. In the end, what Hillel said to them is, let's see what the people do, and
I had read that when Moshe broke the first Tabernacle, that was the place where we would get things, there would be Malchus.
Yes, there is a discussion like that. That the first luchos had an ideal to pristine nature, and the second luchos there was something more built in. I don't know whether they're talking about bad machlokas or good machlokas there.
Mm-hmm.
Is the truth, because all those gemaras that talk about when Hashem or the midrash, when Hashem gave the Torah, he gave it with 49 ways of looking later and forth. Are they talking about the first luchos or the second luchos? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Already when you're talking the first and the second luchos, this is almost like a theoretical hashkafic discussion, because we never got the first luchos. There was never a system of the first luchos at play. You know, they appeared and then disappeared, smashed on the floor, and we only ever lived Torah according to the second luchos. So, but it's really, Rav Tzadok HaKohen talks about this kind of thing as well. I don't know exactly the answer to your question, but so we'd have to try and find some way of trying to see how this works in. And we're really looking historically as much as hashkafically as to what happened. What does it mean this was the first machlokas? What it means is, this was the first major machlokas that was unresolvable. Of course there's always been machlokas, but there's always been a mechanism for resolving machlokas. What is that mechanism? The Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin. What we're seeing is a breakdown of the system of the Sanhedrin, and we'll see why in a minute. Have a look at number 7. This is a very important Rambam, explaining how people solved disputes when the temple was there. Kishihaya Beis Din HaGadol time. When the Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin, was in existence, Lo Haisa Machlokas Bisrael. There was no Machlokas. I don't know what the Rambam says about what I called last week good Machlokas. I don't know if the Rambam subscribes to the good Machlokas theory. We know other people do, but I haven't seen it in the Rambam. It may well be that it's there and I just don't know about it. But definitely the Rambam is saying that bad Machlokas didn't apply, didn't happen. Any din that they weren't clear about, if a Jew was not clear, he'd ask his local based in. Im yadu, if they knew, amrulai, then they told him. Im lav, if not, hari hashoyel, then the questioner, im oisa based in, with that based in, or im shaluchav, or its representative, oilim li Yerushalayim, would go up to Yerushalayim. It's important to get clear. There was no appeal system from the Beis Din, and there is no appeal system. It's not like in America, you go to the court and they give you a verdict or a judgment, a ruling, whatever, and you don't like it, so you appeal to the next court up and you keep going to the Supreme Court. That's not how it works. If you go to a Beis Din and they give you a psak, that's it, you can't appeal the psak. If the psak is right, so that's it. If the psak is just completely wrong based on an error, you don't need to appeal, you just ask for another Beis Din. Okay? So here, the issue is that they didn't know. The lower Beis Din didn't know. They wouldn't give up Sakka. They didn't know. So they went to Yerushalayim. They showed them the Beis Din Sheba Har HaBayis, and they asked the Beis Din on Har HaBayis. Im Yadu, this is not the Sanhedrin. This is the next one down. Im Yadu, if they knew Amrulah, then they tell them the answer, and that way they will go home happy. Ve'im La, then if not, Hakol Baim Le Beis Din Shel Petach HaAzara. They go to the next Beis Din, which is at the entrance to the temple courtyard, which is still not the Sanhedrin. It's the next one up. Okay? Im Yadu, if they knew, Amrulahem, they would tell them. But Im Lav, and if not, there's only one more place left to go. Hakol Baim Lelishkas Hagazis. They would come to the chamber of the hewn stone, Lebeistin Hagodl, to the Sanhedrin, Vashoilem, and they'd ask them. Now, Im Haya Hadava Shinoilad Boyasophic Lakol, Yodua Etzel Beistin Hagodl. If the Beis Din Hagodl knew the answer to the question that they had, Bein Mipia Kabbalah, whether on column 1 on my diagram, through the Kabbalah, through the received tradition, Bein Pi Hamidah Shadana Bo, or any column 2, the drushes that they made, if they had an answer, they'd give them the answer immediately. Imloy, if they didn't have an answer to this question, if it's a new question, a new idea, Hayadavar Borah Etzel based in Hagadol, Imloy Hayadavar Haborah Etzel based in Hagadol, if it wasn't clear to the based in Hagadol, done in Voibashas, and they would discuss it at that point, v'noisnin, they would debate it, b'davar, achi eskimu kulam, until they reached unanimous consensus, or yamdu l'minyan, or they take a vote, yelchu acharav, and then they follow the majority, but yomru l'kala shoylim, and they say to all the questioners, kach halacha, this is the halacha, we've created the halacha. We created the emes, and we saw last time when we talked about the emes of Shemaim and the emes here. That is the emes. That is the truth. That is what God wants of us. The majority of the Sanhedrin of God. But they go home. Now, here's the key. Mishabatl based in Hagadol. Once the based in Hagadol stopped working, Rav Samachlokas Bisrael. Then there was no way of resolving Machlokas. Machlokas increased. Okay, Zematame, Venoisin Tam. This rabbi would say Tame and would give his reasoning. Letvarov. Vazematar Venoisin Tam Letvarov. Vazet Oise, Vazematar. And he ended up with a system where instead of having a unanimous sack, because there can be no machlokas, because ultimately you go to the top and the top takes a vote. And there's never an even number on the Sanhedrin. They have to have 71. That's why. It has to go 36-35. Okay? But once this system, and we'll see why, stopped working, you ended up with, Beis Hillel says this, Beis Shammai says this, Rabbi Yeshua says this, Rabbi Eliezer says this. That was never meant to be. And you may wonder, why is it that the rabbis and the Mishnah who are arguing do not date before this point in history, the two Yosefs? Why don't we see David HaMelech says this and Shmuel HaNavi says this? Moshe Rabbeinu says this and Yeshua says that. The reason is because the only time that opinions remained as opinions is when this system began to break down. Ideally, there should be no machlokas on an ongoing basis, but there has to be a resolution with the Sanhedrin. That's the first important historical point to note, which is that machlokas began to creep in this particular part of Jewish history. Now, yes?
I'm just trying to think of something I heard that every question that was ever asked was asked at Sinai to Moshe.
That's a midrashic idea. That's a midrashic idea, and the idea that Moshe Rabbeinu had, I think what that's talking about is that Moshe Rabbeinu had the maximum possible understanding of intellectual Torah that any human being could ever have. So, as it were, every question that was ever asked was known to Moshe Rabbeinu in that sense. But there's all sorts of midrashic ideas about Moshe Rabbeinu, that he saw everything that everyone was ever going to see in the future through Nevuah, whatever that means. We're not really dealing with the kind of what was the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. We talk about that in the 13 Inferno.
So I mean, my question is, was it all asked before and then the Masorah was just lost?
No. In fact, that's the next source. The Rambam thinks that at this stage in the discussion, someone might ask that question. Okay? And that's why the Rambam jumps in. In fact, in fairness to the Rambam actually, if you look in source number 8, you look at the source, it's actually the Halacha before source number 7. So he wants you to avoid that question before you even reach source number 7. So you're obviously asking the good question, Meira, because the Rambam's preempting you. And he says in number 8, I put it after because I think just in terms of the discussion it goes better after, but the Rambam put it before. And he says like this, you see now why he did, because otherwise you'd never have asked that. Number 8, he says, Divrei Kabbalah, receive stuff from Moshe Rabbeinu, Ein Behem Machlokas La'olam. There was never any Machlokas. Because I was Yitim Saboy Machlokas, everything that you find that there is any machlokas, but yadusha einu kabbalah mimoshe rabbeinu, you know that that's not part of the Masorah. And therefore, what was being debated here, 90%, I don't know, 95% of the halachas that are generated in Torah Shabbat Peh are not just coming straight from Moshe Rabbeinu. They're coming as part of the process of generation of halacha, either in column number 2 through the drashas, or column number 3 through the drabbanons, which all post-date Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's what they're arguing about. Now, until this point in history, there's always been a way of resolving that argument. This rabbi thinks we should darshan the posuk to give this halacha. And this rabbi says we should darshan the same posuk to give a different halacha. So what's the answer? The Sanhedrin decides. This is the definitive drasha. And then in 50 years, a new Sanhedrin comes along and says, no, we think this is the definitive drasha. Seder. They can change their mind. That's also in the Rambam. That's clear in Halacha too. But there's never going to be an ongoing machlokas. But the stuff from Moshe Rabbeinu, the way the Rambam anyway is learning the concepts of Torah Shebaal Peh, did not hand us down a massive halachic guide of all the questions that were ever asked in Halacha. And the only reason that we didn't know the answers to them is because we forgot the answers. That is how other people might learn the concepts of Torah Mesinai, but the Rambam is extremely unhappy with that. Because A, doesn't seem to fit the way the Gemara works anyway, the way that we see the structure of it, and B, is basically saying the whole Masorah is messed up. That's the downside, if you like. There is a view, there is a point of view, there is an idea like that, and I think this is what's taught in most high schools. That the entire Torah Shabbat Peh was given to Moshe on Sinai, and was handed down faithfully throughout the generations. And I've made this point before. The Rambam is so against that, because we'll see a source in a minute, he says it's based on a misunderstanding of how the Torah of Sinai works. And it also basically says the entire Jewish religion is just messed up. Basically, just to put it in rather crude terms. Because it says everything was given on Sinai, everything now is a machlokas, therefore, how do I know anything I'm doing is right? The Rambam says, chas v'shalom, you should say such a thing, is based on a misunderstanding. Yeah.
So, if that's the case, the idea that you shouldn't argue with rabbis who are from the previous generations...
There is no such idea today.
No, but back, with the Tanaim and whatever, wasn't there still that idea?
We'll talk about that. It's not so straightforward. It's not so straightforward. There's even a question, why is it the Amoraim don't argue with the Tanaim? What is it, how do they draw that line? And where do we draw that line? This is something which we'll have to talk about soon, because we're soon going to get into kind of strata of rabbis. Rishonim, Achronim, Tanaim, Amoraim, Gaonim, and we're going to have to work out who can argue with who. Once the halacha becomes codified, which we're going to see from next time, these kind of questions become relevant. Who can argue with who? At this point in Jewish history, it's irrelevant. Because no one can argue with anyone, because the Sanhedrin decides ultimately. And therefore, that's the end of it. That's why we want a Sanhedrin back. That's why we need one. Because that will bring a certain uniformity to Psak Halacha, which will drive the whole Halacha in a more unified and maybe even slightly different direction. Now, let's go on. The Rambam's analysis, we saw in number 7, that this going up to the Sanhedrin, is brought out in a couple of key sources. Look at number 9 and 10. Tanya, I'm Rabbi Yosef. Mitchila loy hayur miramar b'brachlokes b'Yisrael. There was no originally, this is the Gemara that Rambam is basing his halacha. Originally there was not much machlokas. Loy hayur marbim, there was no, growth of machlokas. Uncontrollable machlokas. Obviously there's always been disagreement, but it was soluble. And he goes through the whole thing. There was a big base then, and if you didn't get an answer with a little one, you're going up and up and up and up and up until the very top. And then it says, Mishirabu Talmide Shammai v'Hillel. The Talmidim of Shammai and Hillel. Now, Hillel and Shammai themselves were in the generation before the destruction. The Talmidim of Shammai and Hillel are basically the generation of the Churban, just before the Churban. When they became prevalent, Shaloi, look at these words carefully, Shaloi Shimshu Kol Sarachah. They weren't able to, or they didn't do Shimush properly. What's Shimush? What's a Shamash? A service, exactly. A Shamash is somebody who serves somebody else. In other words, the Gemara talks about, in order to learn how to be a rabbi, like a real rabbi, not like today, but like real rabbis, when they had real rabbis, Smich or whatever, you have to learn Mikra, you have to learn Mishnah, you have to learn Talmud, you have to do Shimush. Shimush means like almost like a rabbinic apprenticeship. It's not good enough that you learnt all the material clear in your head. You actually have to glue yourself to senior rabbinic figures and see how they really do it. And they weren't able to do that for reasons we'll see soon. Because of that, Rabu Machlokas Bisrael. Machlokas increased greatly. But now says Torah Kashtei Torahs. And the Torah became like two Torahs.
What were the different approaches?
Hillel and Shammai themselves didn't seem to disagree on very much. We'll see that in the Rambam in a minute. But Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai seem to begin to see life in radically different ways, to the point that actually their approaches, their methodological approaches, and maybe even their hashkafic approaches, started producing, when you diverge a very tiny amount at the beginning, that divergence becomes quite marked the further down the line you go. And so it's saying by the time you got to the Churban, they actually ended up almost making two Torahs. Now, we could make a study of what were the different methodologies of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Why did they see things differently? Oh, so that we talked about a little bit with Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua and the Baskol and all that kind of stuff. In the end, Beis Hillel became dominant over Beis Shammai. And we ended up ruling like Beis Hillel, and Beis Shammai were rejected. Okay, but one could make, and people have made a study, you could take all of the different machlikot in Gemara between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, of which there are many, and see if you can find a common thread between them as to why Shammai, where they were coming from, etc. Beis Shammai. It's a very interesting sort of study of the way, there's a macro study of the meta rules of Gemara. But here it seems for our purposes the Torah was turning into schism. Okay? And this was very serious. This was in danger of ripping the Jewish people apart. The Tosefta, which is a parallel source, gives another sociological understanding. Look at number 10. Mishirabu zechuche halev. When the zechuche halev, which we'll define in a minute, became great, Rabu machlokas b'Yisrael, that's when machlokas became great. And who are they? Hein hein shofchei damim. Murderers. And what the Tosefta is saying here is another important factor, which is part of this whole process at the end of the Second Temple was not just a difference in methodology, a difference in, if you like, academic Torah approach. There was a societal breakdown going on. Just think about historically what was going on at this time. After the Hanukkah story, we had the whole upheaval of the Greek Hellenization, which came to a head, if you like, in the Hanukkah story, where there was this enormous war within the Jewish people between the Hellenists, the Mityavnim, who were Jews, who were into Hellenization, and the Hashmonaim, who wanted to turn that process back to a more, if you like, traditional non-Hellenized system. So you had that whole upheaval which ripped, you know, the insides out of the Jewish people in the middle of the Second Temple period. I mean, the beginning of the Second Temple period didn't start great either. The whole Yishuv was started by a very small number of people. Most of them stayed in Babel. The small number of people had to fight every step of the way to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. They had to fight with the Shomronim. They had to fight with all sorts of people. Okay? Then they had this enormous upheaval of the Hellenization. And then when the Hashmonaim established themselves as the rulers and the Second Commonwealth, or Third Commonwealth, how you want to count it, was established, then there was a massive civil war within the Hashmonaim. The sons of Alexander Yanai, a couple of generations after the Maccabim, they themselves, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, started a massive civil war, which again ripped the Kishkas out of the Jewish people. Jew was fighting Jew. Jew was killing Jew. And everyone was kind of caught up in the middle. And then you have the Sadducees, who developed their whole approach to like a rejection of rabbinic interpretation and hermeneutics. And we had that started around the time of Tzadok. Tzadok and Baisos were students of Antigonus Ishtoko, which is also brewing all through this period. And you had the corruption of the Kohanim, who became more and more and more Sadducee in their approach, such that the whole Beit HaMikdash service became rejected by many as being ultimately corrupted. You had breakaway groups. You had breakaway groups like the Dead Sea Scroll sect that went down into Qumran, having rejected what was going on. The topic you had the Sadducees. What you're looking at is a big mess. Many scales of bigger mess than what we have today. Many, 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 many levels of magnitude bigger. And the whole Jewish people was on the verge of ripping themselves apart.
Because it was impossible to identify what was Jewish.
Then. Correct. And this had an effect on the oral law. And this, we're going to see now, the Rambam says, is why the students of Shammai and Hillel were unable to study properly. And that's why bad machlokas set in. Once that became irreversible, and really the Churban was the end of it. It wasn't the end of it, but it was the point at which it was clear it was irreversible. Churban Beis HaMikdash meant that there had to be a new system in place. And we see the generation after the Churban, Rabbi Akiva and so, began the process of rehabilitating Torah Shebaal Peh in a new system which would fit the new reality. There was no turning back. There was not going to be a Sanhedrin in the way that they used to be. Once the Sanhedrin left, look in source number 11 for a second, says the Gemara, Arba'im Shana Ashaloi Charav HaBayis. Even 40 years, 1 second before the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Galta La Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin exiled itself, Vayashva La B'chanu Yotan, it went to sit down in the shops, down, it moved itself down into Yerushalayim. Meaning it ceased to have any real power as a Sanhedrin. The Ramban in number 12, I'm not going to go into that because I want to read 13. The Ramban in number 12 explains that there was no longer any Sanhedrin. It became clear after the Churban there was no turning back. And that's when we started, really, the crystallization of the Torah Shebaal Peh. The formation of what we call the Mishnah, the Talmud eventually. It started already with Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, but then Rabbi Akiva made a very significant inroad, and then eventually we ended up with the Mishnah. So you have to understand the Mishnah wasn't just some kind of something out of nowhere. At a certain point in Jewish history, someone woke up and said, oh, you know, let's write down the Torah Shebaal Peh. Although we'll see it wasn't really written necessarily in the time of Mishnah, but let's crystallize it. It came as a result of all of these things and the need to stem the tide before it was too late. Someone had a question, yeah.
Is it possible to have good machlokes without bad machlokes?
Yes, but there has to be a resolution. Bad machlokes was in there's no resolution. And you end up with these different factions. Good machlokas means that there is an intrinsic worth, value to different ways of looking at things, and the way that the Sanhedrin would argue. In other words, nobody suggests that when the Sanhedrin are arguing with themselves, there's something wrong with that. That's brilliant. The problem is when they're still arguing and there's no resolution, and then become my group and your group and her group. Let's have a look at this Rambam, and we'll finish with this in number 30. It's a bit long, but we'll do it quite fast. This Rambam is from the Hagdamah to the Mishnah, the introduction to the Mishnah, and he says as follows, where he goes through the details of Torah Shabbat Peh. Anyone who thinks that there was machlokas in the things that came down from Moshe Rabbeinu, that were handed down from Moshe, and the reason there's machlokas is because things got forgotten, it was a mistake, but Kabbalah in the tradition, or Shichachol, things got forgotten, and one of them was right, Sodek, but Kabbalah in his Masorah, Vahasheni Tal, but Kabbalah, or Sheshachach, or that they forgot, or Sheloy Shammah Merabbah, Kol Mashi Tzarech Lishmo, or they didn't listen properly. Umeli Raya Lekachan, they want to bring a proof. In other words, someone who turns around and says, everything came from Moshe Rabbeinu, and things began to get messed up, and they want to bring a proof, Mimashi Amru, from the Gemara we just saw. Mishe Rabbu Tamid Shammah Vehilel Sheloy Shimshu Kol Tzarech, and they didn't work properly. Rab Samach Lokas be Israel, Venatis Turkish Day Torahs. You want to bring me a proof from that? It proves that what people weren't listening properly and the Torah got messed up. Hine Zeh Chai Hashem Davar Maguna. This is a disgraceful approach, he says. This is disgraceful. Umuzer Ma'aid. It is extremely strange to say such a thing. For Hudama Bilti Nochon is simply incorrect. The Loi Matim Leklalim. It doesn't fit with any of the general principles of Choshed Ba'anashim Shemehem Kibalnu Es HaTorah. You're doubting the people from whom we received the Torah. You're saying it all got messed up. Mm-hmm. That's just a misunderstanding of the nature of Masorah. It's a terrible thing to say. Because it's bottle, it's just nonsense. Behavior Oysam Yidei Hashkofa Nifsedis. It brings people to a very degraded Hashkofa. Zomir Yidias Divrei Chachamim. It's based on a lack of understanding of the sources. Tanim Tzayim B'Talmud, which you can read in the Talmud. We see that the perish, the stuff that we got from Moshe Rabbeinu, was pure, it was never debated, it was never discussed, it was never doubted. The trouble is, they're not making a distinction between column 1 and column number 2. He says people just don't have that on the board in front of them. That's why they're making such a fundamental error. So he says, now I'm going to tell you really where machlokas comes from. Aval amru mishirab talmid shama vehillel. In the second paragraph, what they meant when they said that when the talmidim of Shammah and Hillel increased, okay, shaloi shimshu kol tarkam, rabsa machlokas Israel. That's what caused machlokas. Inyan davar zeh boromoid. It's actually very clear when you analyze it. Kishnei anoshim. Now he gives an interesting analysis of why people disagree. Shnei anoshim. He's talking about bad machlokas here. As I said, the Rambam may only subscribe to the bad machlokas theory. I don't know if he subscribes to the good machlokas theory at all. But let's just look at this. Kishnei anoshim shehem shavim b'havana. Two people who are equal in wisdom and understanding. Ube'iyun. Ube'yidiyas ha'kalalim. And in knowledge of the principles. Shalamdi mehem. Okay, which they are learning from. Loi tiyeh b'neihem machlokas b'masha loindim. B'achatim midas b'shum panim. There shouldn't be too much disagreement between them. If people are of equal understanding and intelligence, and they learned properly, and they're all working off the same system, there shouldn't really be that much room to disagree. The Imtiya, and if there is, Tiya Mayatis, there should be a minimal disagreement. And we indeed don't find that Shammai and Hillel themselves, they hardly disagree on anything. Just a very few halachas. Because then the nature of the way they studied, okay, the in whatever way that they were learning the different methodologies of hermeneutics or whatever, exegesis, they were very similar to each other. Which, whatever this way where Hillel was learning, Shammai was basically learning the same way. However, when their students weren't able to learn properly, and they became weak in the way they were able to analyze things, the hashva'a, at least in comparison, b'shamay v'hillel, to their master Shammah and Hillel, Rabbi Sehim, their teachers, nafla machlokas by name. Then they began to have machlokas, v'shasa matam matam, when they were disagreeing, b'harbe inyanim. Because each was going according to his own understanding. And according to what was known to him. Let's not blame them, he says. Let's not blame them for doing that. Because you can't fault two people who want to disagree and hold them liable that they should disagree on the level of Yeshua or Pinchas. We are what we are. We are products of our environment, says the Rambam. They couldn't do any better. Think about it. The yeshivas were in turmoil. They were political. The guys were all running in and out, fighting wars. You know, spending half the time that they should have been studying, fighting in the army, and running in and running out, and doing all that kind of stuff. It was an atmosphere. Well, you could ask today whether there's any comparisons with today, or whether you can say that actually what you're dealing with here is almost like a revolutionary situation. So, Baruch Hashem, today we have a fairly stable situation, and long may continue. So you have 2 or 3 years in yeshiva, and if you go to Hezda, then you have a year in the army, and then you go back to yeshiva. We're talking about a situation there which was in absolute turmoil, where you can imagine all the guys in yeshiva half the time what they're talking about is politics rather than Torah. Why? Because that's the way that the zeitgeist. And the Rambam says we're not to blame them for this, and we're not to judge them for this. We can't even blame them for not being like their masters or greater, because God never required us to be as great as the people before us. He only required us to be as great as who we're able to be in the times that we live in. We have to listen to the rabbis of whatever generation we live in. But the Rashta, you go to the rabbis of your own times. You can't turn around and say they're not good enough. This is why they started having machlokas. Not that they made a mistake in what they learned. And the one got it right and one got it wrong. And it becomes so much clearer if you think of it like this, he says. How important is this to understand Torah? The reason the Machlokes set in was not because people were forgetting things, it's because the nature of the way people thought about things was changing because of the external circumstances. And that's what caused Machlokes. And what needed to bring them together was peace and security. At the end of the day, that's why we daven, that's why we ask for Mashiach. The Rambam says elsewhere, we daven for Mashiach so that there'll be peace and security, so we can get our heads straight. Our heads can't be straight when we're running around dodging weapons. It's just not possible. And therefore, this system, if you like, set in at the end of the Second Temple, and whilst they felt it was reversible for a while, it became clear it became irreversible. And what we need to do next time, really, is we need to look at the steps that began to be taken by these people themselves, and certainly by those that came just after them. Rabbi Akiva represents in many ways a synthesis. His rabbis were Rabbi Shua and Rabbi Lezer. Rabbi Yeshua was the scion of Beis Hillel. Rabbi Yeshua was the scion of Beis Shammai. And they had this big standoff, remember, with the oven and all that kind of stuff. Rabbi Akiva was the student of both Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. He tried to dance at 2 chasnas. And to a large degree he succeeded. And therefore Rabbi Akiva represents the beginning, the new beginning of a new synthesis of trying to bring these 2 Torahs together and start from there. You'll see that this is why when we, in Sfereta Omer, when we start getting all upset about the death of Rabbi Akiva's students, you may ask yourselves, well, that's all, not belittling it, but that was a long time ago. And the Jewish people have had a lot of tragedies, a lot bigger than that, over the last couple of thousand years. Why are we still thinking about Rabbi Akiva's students? And the answer is because Rabbi Akiva, we'll see, was the new hope, the new beginning of a new Torah which was synthesized, and when his students all died, it was tragedy beyond belief. And he had to start again, all over again. And that was what led eventually to the Mishnah. But that's for next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, where we're going to look at the beginning of the formation of the crystallization of Torah and the turning of it into a text. More of that later. For now, we'll leave it there.